Hello, and welcome to the OnFIF podcast, a weekly discussion on key trends in investment and economic policy from some of the world's leading commentators. On this week's episode, we talk about the macroeconomic implications of climate change.
In that sense, we have to stare at these projections, take them to heart, and act now, even if today's growth rate at a big event that one might publicize cannot actually pick up the growth effects of climate change.
We talked to Professor Vinod Thomas, visiting professor here at the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy in Singapore, and also former senior vice president of the World Bank. Professor Thomas, welcome.
Welcome, thank you very much.
Very good to have you here in Singapore today. So today's topic of climate change is obviously one that's very pertinent in today's investment landscape. And given we're in Asia, it's probably fair to say that Asia does suffer or receive a disproportionate share of climate-related disasters, ranging from floods to earthquakes and other such disasters. Other than geography, I guess, really, is there something that's causing this increase in natural disasters? Is it fair to say that there has been an increase in recent years?
When you stare at the numbers, it is striking that there is a very clear difference between what are called hydrometeorological phenomena, which is floods and storms, plus what might be called climatic events, which are droughts and heat waves, on the one side, and the so-called geophysical phenomena, earthquakes and volcanoes and a few other things. So the question came up when we did a report on natural disasters in Asia. Of course, their presence is intense, and we also think it's growing. A reporter asked, why the sharp difference in your curves, the ones that belong to the hydrometeorological and climatological to a different extent, seem to be going up steadily, and that is not the same for earthquakes and volcanoes. The latter are extremely important. They kill a lot of people because if they hit the urban areas, the density of population decides how many people will be badly affected. And yet, the increase that we see secularly over a three-decade period really is striking in the case of floods, storms, as well as droughts and heat waves, much more in Africa and much more in other regions than Asia. So the question is why? Now, we need to step back when the question is raised, having noted that they are rising, why? There are definitely more than one factor here, and the socio-economic factors are very important. And one is simply the exposure of people. There are more people located in harm's way. It's just a fact, particularly in South Asia, but also in East Asia. Southeast Asia has some of the highest densities of population. And where do people end up locating when land is tight? Land is one factor of production that's fixed. Well, we can vary it going higher and higher, but still it is in a sense fixed. So exposure is one big factor. A second one, and here the trends go somewhat in different directions, but at the end of the day, the vulnerability of people to withstand the event has been changing. On the one side, death rates have come down for similar events because of early warning and people being able to evacuate and find places to actually find shelter. So deadly storm today in Bangladesh kills a fraction of the number of people that used to be killed 10 years ago and 10 years before that and so on. So at the same time, the damages of disasters clearly is going up for various reasons, including the difficulty of withstanding these events in terms of rebuilding costs, and all of those things have also risen. So point number one is exposure, point number two is vulnerability. Point number three is really the new effect on the block, and that is the intensity of the hazard itself is different. So a place like Singapore never witnessed an extraordinary storm until Typhoon Vami hit in 2001. In the Philippines, I think the human race has not seen the likes of Hurricane Haiyan, and then in the United States, 2017 was an extraordinary year. And these are not just stories. The statistical storyline gives you the sense clearly that the intensity of events, or events that used to be once in 100 years, now happen every other year. And that is a change. So the dial points to factors beyond exposure and beyond vulnerability to climate change? And that's a big question on which we have done quite a lot of research. Very compelling evidence that suggests that the emissions of carbon dioxide into the air and the global warming, on which there is no dispute, the last 17 years, 16 of them were the hottest ever. And people tell stories of how they have not in recent memory remembered sweating so much or looking for shade so much or getting dehydrated or simply having to go to the hospital. So this is the change. The relationship between that warming, let's say warming of the sea level, to precipitation being greater and therefore the rains being more heavy and the storms, the winds being heavier, faster and so on, that is the part that's harder to pinpoint one-to-one to climate change. But here again, what is not questionable is that these sort of phenomenon in a given year has a higher chance of happening today than they did 50 years ago.
So there is a definite increased intensity and there's indisputable evidence of the impact of climate change. I mean, really, what effect does this have on the economy within the region and globally?
So on the economic impacts, of course, people's discomfort and inconvenience is clear cut. These are headline news today in a way that we have never seen. They would not be headline news if people didn't feel bothered by the phenomenon of climate change and natural disasters in a way that they had not experienced before. The challenge, however, when it comes to policymakers is, does this translate into economic growth rate? And if it didn't, it'll get short shrift. So there is no doubt that some of the events have been very costly. So for example, 2011 great floods of Thailand, some $45 billion in losses, translate to something like 13% of GDP. Who is going to say that that's not a big number? But if you take a huge economy like Japan, even the tsunami and Fukushima event, let's say it costs more than $200 billion. But as a percentage of the GDP, it may not be that great. And similarly, Hurricane Haiyan, which may have killed 10,000 people, in the Philippines, in terms of economic losses, since it was a rural area heavily, would have had a 2-3% impact on the economy. So these are sizable numbers in absolute terms. They sometimes are not big in percentage terms. And even more difficult would be then quantifying that in terms of the growth rate, not the level, but the change. That would be a challenge. And you would be hard pressed to find more than a 0.2-0.5% impact on the growth rate. And sometimes people will attribute that to a variety of events and therefore get by without incorporating this impact into growth projections and therefore growth policies. It's an unfortunate scenario in which it might take an even bigger crisis to really put the focus on climate-related disasters. And often that has been the case. We've had huge responses to environmental crisis in Japan in the 40s and 50s in UK, the London fog, or the burning of the Ohio River, the United States in the 70s. Minamita is the event that took place in Japan, mercury poisoning. So things had to get so bad that to the naked eye, it was clear that the economic impact, tangible ones, as well as intangible ones translate into growth rates are big enough for us to act. The problem, unfortunately, is that climate phenomena, they are accumulating and to some extent irreversible. In other words, we are today going to be living with what has already happened for another 50, 70 years, regardless of what we do. So you got to act before it is too late. And in fact, you have to act far many years ahead of before it's too late. In that sense, we have to stare at these projections, take them to heart, and act now, even if today's growth rate at a big event that one might publicize cannot actually pick up the growth effects of climate change.
So you still think the resistance to managing climate risk by policymakers is because of this lack of a big shock?
Big enough shock that would shake you up. And in 2017 in the United States, we may have come close, but we have the perverse phenomenon that with such incredible costs on one's doorstep, the United States walks out of the climate agreement at Paris. So you can see the political economy is a lead and lag, and the timing may just not work in favor of taking action in time.
Well, definitely on the political scene, there's mixed views in regards to the impact of climate change, also on the policy side as well. But do you think there's now a greater increase by global investors in recognizing the financial risks of climate change?
Yes, I think if you look at the World Economic Forum reports and also the discussions of the recent years, the organization puts out the top issues of concern to business communities around the world. And climate change and the environment, they have featured in the top 3 to 5 consistently for some time. But in the last year, if you look at the quadrant of high probability and high impact events, these really top the list. So there is no doubt about the recognition from the business community and the political leaders to be there. The translation of that into action is held up by a few critical factors. I think when we look at what it takes to switch the current growth path, switch from a high carbon growth path to a low carbon growth path, there are some very concrete components of that. Many things can be done. Among them is to switch to a low carbon energy use. Energy is the big ticket item. And so there, if you can find so-called win-wins, like improve efficiency of energy use, electricity use, make the buildings more energy efficient, I think most people would agree. And then the difficulties may be practical, pragmatic, financing, you know, intermediation, and all sorts of things. But still, at the end of the day, you could say, okay, that's a win-win, we can do that. But if you take the question of switching out of fossil fuels to renewables, even if we believe that they are net wins, meaning at the end of the day we'll all win, but in the process some will win and some will lose, there the political economy comes in clearly. So there's a very strong lobby in favor of fossil fuels, and for good reasons. Livelihoods are at stake, and then they also have a low cost up to a point. Even now they are low cost, so you can understand it's not a irrational support, but that explains why the political economy, even if you think there is a net win overall, the win-win may not be in favor of moving, at least not moving fast enough. So all kinds of transitionary mechanisms and methods and distributional effects need to be taken into account to get there.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting that Singapore itself is a financial and business hub. There was a survey done by KPMG at the end of last year, and the finding was that few Singaporean firms really still see climate change as a significant final risk to consider. Still much work to be done in this part of the world.
Right. Well, Singapore is away from the Ring of Fire, and as I said, only in 2001 there was this major shock, but there have been water shortages and drought-like situations in the last few years in Singapore. And one of my students here did a very interesting piece of work showing how the water levels are precarious even in Singapore. We talk about Jakarta and Bangkok as being close to crisis proportions, but here there is this phenomenon as well to some extent. But where there is some protection of those areas, either because it's a botanical garden and there is some natural protection provided or what have you, those levels are better protected. So it shows the risk, but also the benefits to action, even in Singapore.
To our listeners there, we're located here at the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy, which is in a very beautiful location in central Singapore within the actual botanical gardens, which Professor Thomas just referred to there. So we do benefit from some of the natural beauty here. So you mentioned in your book, Climate Change and Natural Disasters, that economic growth will become sustainable only if governments, political actors, and local communities combine natural disaster prevention and look to control climate change into national growth strategies. Can you outline what are some of the strategies you envisioned, and how can the synergy of these three parties play a role in preventing and controlling climate change?
I think clearly government policies are crucial in this area, because at the end of the day, there is a problem of valuation. If we buy something in the market, we pay a price, and so the production and the consumption of that good is rationalized through people indicating how much is it worth to you. When it comes to the air that we breathe, or even the water that we use in many instances, there is no price. And when that is the case, the overuse and the overexploitation, the economists call the externalities, negative in this case, really dominate. And therefore, setting some prices one way or the other for air, or put a different way, putting a tax or a penalty for messing up that air, be it through carbon emissions or other sources of pollution, is an essential part of the equation. There we have the government or the national leader's role come in at least two ways. One is, since air also is easily transferable from one border to another, it's a kind of a regional and global good. So this price needs to have a valuation set a bit internationally. And that's why organizations like the UN, IPCC, and so on, and the effort to have some agreements, behind them there is some good economics, which is, that's one way to set a price globally. And then at the country level, of course, there's a lot you can do. There is one segment which, regardless of the global benefits of climate change being addressed can have huge health benefits at the local level. Maybe that's the first place to go, because that is tangible, and the overlap between those sorts of pollutions that are local and hurt people's health and the global part is quite strong. So for example, black carbon in the air, if Beijing cuts down the pollution because it's worried about the loss of life expectancy in real time, or Delhi, if you cannot choke to death at some times of the year, that can be addressed cutting the black carbon, which is good for climate change as well. That's a different kind of win-win, kind of a low-hanging fruit. I'm not saying this is easy, but this has to be done. It should be mandatory. There's no two ways about it, because decent health is a human right, and that also helps the climate situation. So maybe start with those in a big way, with a sense of urgency, and then continue to work on the global pricing of air as well, a la the Paris Agreement, and get everybody to do the same. Why? Because people are worried that if I only did this and my neighbor didn't do it, I may have a comparative disadvantage. For instance, if producers in East Asia feel that this is not an urgency, they would be reluctant to do so, and even more so if they believe that they are the only ones who are going to take action and others won't. So there is a merit in having this reciprocal as opposed to unilateral. Although the unilateral part may be underemphasized today, like the case of cleaning up one's own cities.
Yeah, that's very true. I suppose it's that difficult balancing act, isn't it, both at the national, regional, and global level of implementing and crafting these different policies, both for short-term contingencies such as annual floods, but then the longer and medium-term goals of moving to a more carbon-neutral economy. So disaster risk reduction is an investment that goes beyond relief and reconstruction to a dual approach of prevention and recovery. You highlight the need to view investments in climate mitigation as investments in economic growth. Is there any concrete evidence which shows the effect of investing in climate change mitigation being effective in boosting the economic growth of a country?
Indeed, there is, and to go to the primary concern, which is that disasters, when they hit us, we react, but we do not plan for them ahead of time. That is one that is particularly problematic if you believe that disasters are increasing and becoming more systematic. If it was entirely an act of God on which we have no control, I can see that it might be rational just to wait for it to happen and then react, because you may be preparing forever and God reacts differently to what you had thought. So it would not be sound economics to overdo preparation when it's not in your hands. However, if now you add to the equation the 3 points that I mentioned, exposure is getting worse, vulnerability is highly problematic, and climate change is changing the situation, then you know that the probability of these things happening with great damage is there and high, and there's something systematic about it, then it would be extremely rational not to plan for it. Just like people take insurance on their house if they're located in a particularly problematic area. It's no difference. The case is even stronger here, but since it's a collective question, people may be less inclined to chip in to an insurance program that helps everybody else. If you were paying for it, maybe somebody else will gain from that without paying, and so people make some decisions along those lines. Now, does this pay off? Well, the studies that we have show they pay off hugely. There's still a question, if that's the case, then why don't we see the results as well hugely? But where you have early warning systems put in place, the difference in death tolls is incredibly striking. And the Bangladesh case of about 300,000 people killed in a storm in the 70s to about 400 in the 2000s for comparable wind speed and comparable intensity of the storm is a striking story. Japan is another case in point, where I think Japan probably invests like 5% of its GDP in disaster risk management, which is probably a very good number and one that others might want to emulate. But the payoffs to that, you have to look at the counterfactual. How terrible would have been the death toll of an earthquake if they didn't have the incredibly sophisticated ways of predicting and then importantly disseminating that information to people? And they've got to a point where that dissemination is tailored to the age and the disabilities and the abilities of people to react and so on, so that people know that depending on your situation, here is what you need to do. That said, there's still a lot of uncertainty, as our professor here likes to say. When you're thinking of the big ones, which are happening more and more, then you almost have to throw away even these great rules and behave even more than what the rules had called for. For instance, in the case of the Fukushima event, school children who were taught and drilled into them the idea of finding a higher plane, seeing how intense the event was, put that lesson aside and went to even a much higher plane, and they were all saved. I guess there were no deaths in that particular area. So rules, yes, but even break the rules and do more depending on how the situation has been changing. So bottom line, prevention pays off. There is still great reluctance to invest in prevention because of the misguided belief that these are totally uncertain and one-off events. If that mindset can change, that would then play a bigger role than all the economic policies together.
Very good. Thank you, Professor Thomas, for that very interesting discussion. Very good to talk about not only the increase in exposure and vulnerability to climate change, but also its impact on economic growth and the continuing challenges in implementing the correct strategies for policymakers in this area. We will be holding a high-level seminar here in Singapore on the 17th of July, which will be looking specifically at the impact of climate change on central banks and other public investors globally. You can find further details of that on our website. We look forward to seeing more of you there, and also yourself, Professor Thomas, if you're available. And we'd like to thank you again, Professor Thomas, for joining us today. And we hope you two listeners also enjoyed the podcast.